Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Shekman. There's nothing about the conflicts in the world today that are traditional. Asymmetric enemies often succeed by failing, and the use of overwhelming force and strength can often empower more fragile power to greater recruitment and greater political success. The forces of creative destruction, the nimbleness of the small, and the habits of grand powers to fight the next war with the lessons of the last one all contribute to the dramatically changing nature of warfare. Given this, how do we develop any kind of strategic framework for the 21st century? Do we even need one? And what happens if we don't have one? Trying to examine all of this is some of the work of the New England Complex Systems Institute, a research and education institute, a pioneer in the field of complex system science that addresses issues like education, international development, and military conflict. My guest, Professor Yanir Bar-Yam, is the founding president of the New England Complex System Institute. Professor Bar-Yam has advised government agencies, including the CDC, the SEC, the UN, the World Bank, the U.S. military, and the intelligence community. He's a visiting scholar at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. Professor Bar-Yam has received multiple degrees, including a PhD in physics from MIT, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here today to Radio Who, What, Why. Professor Bar-Yam, welcome to the program.
Pleased to be here. Thank you.
When we look at the nature of conflict today, one of the things that seems to stand out is the complexity of the world today, that the idea of the traditional vision of warfare, two armies opposing each other, has no place really in the world today when one takes into account the economic issues, the social issues, the political issues, all of which enter into the complexity of warfare today. Talk a little bit about that first.
Well, first of all, I would say that, you know, it hasn't been that long since we've had, you know, mass armies confronting each other. I mean, the most recent case that is quite clear is the Gulf War. So I don't think that we should dismiss entirely that that's going to happen again. However, it's pretty clear that most of the conflicts that are happening today are not of that type. There are multiple dimensions, as you've indicated, in which they differ. One is the nature of what the opponents are. While we often think about the U.S. as one of the sides, the other side is really about local disruptions of order, and not about organized nation states with which one is in conflict. And that changes the nature of the engagement. Also, we are constrained in the thinking about the warfare and in performing actions of conflict by the vulnerability of the social systems in which the agents that we might be engaged in conflict with are located. So I think it's helpful to think about a specific example and a specific framing that will help articulate these differences. When we talk about the Gulf War, we had the military force of Iraq sitting in Kuwait in a desert with a line in the desert saying this is the boundary, and we lined up, you know, 500,000 people on one side of the border, and on the other side was the enemy, and then all at once we said go, and the massed forces went forward and attacked the enemy. If we think about what was happening in Afghanistan just a few years later, there were multiple groups that were internally in conflict with each other. We chose a side to associate with, and the terrain was mountainous and very difficult to access. And the roles that were needed were very different in providing assistance to friends and promoting the failure of the antagonistic forces. And eventually, much of the effort was designed to strengthen the socioeconomic system against forces that would disrupt it. And that really is very characteristic of many of the circumstances that we're in conflict today. We are not trying to fight an area. We are trying to fight agents within the area that are disrupting the local order rather than any other sort of large forces that we might oppose. And that creates tremendous differences both in terms of the nature of what we have to do and the strategies that we have to use to achieve our objectives.
How different is that in looking at the Afghanistan model that you just outlined? How different is that than what we experienced in Vietnam, for example?
So Vietnam, in fact, was an earlier case of this kind of complex conflict. Another case that we could give is the Russia in Afghanistan, and surely there have been others across history. But they've become much more prevalent today because, in a sense, the world is very much a single entity. I mean, people think about an opposition between different kinds of groups. People discuss a conflict between Islam and Christianity or something like that. But if we look at what's happening, that's surely not what's taking place. It's small subsets of people that are causing problems to the local circumstance, not just the global conditions. So ISIS is harmful to almost everyone that they touch. And really what we are trying to do is not just to protect ourselves from them, but to protect the world from them, including the local local groups that are present in the areas where they're found. So that's really very much the nature of the situation. Vietnam, in some sense, was quite similar in that there was a conflict between local groups that we engaged in support of one group versus another group, rather than the outright attack that was in the Gulf War. Of course, part of that is not just the socioeconomic conditions, but also the geographic conditions, the complexity of the Vietnamese swamps and terrain is surely part of what made it a highly complex context for military conflict.
Well, there are, as you say, historical antecedents for this kind of complex warfare. To what extent has modern communications and the interconnectedness of groups within these frameworks, to what extent has that changed the nature of war, this kind of warfare today?
Very much so. The major reason is not the local conditions. The major reason is the connection between those local conditions and the global context. So there are at least three ways that manifests itself. One is that the world is vulnerable to any group that is willing to disrupt and destroy social economic institutions wherever in the world they are. And this has to do with the possibility of long-range terrorism, which we've seen from 9/11 to many other cases that have happened since then of global terror attacks. Of course, they were precursor events to that as well. The second way is that disruptors of order attract other disruptors of order from elsewhere in the world. Of course, in ISIS, we see that as well, where they are attracting people from all over the world to reinforce their actions. And the third side is that the opposition to them is global. So we have vulnerability globally. It's part of the fundamental vulnerability of a global system that is highly connected, and we have the attraction of the, if you will, the bad guys, so to speak, from all over the world, and the ones that oppose them for all over the world.
What does this mean, then, for the nature of the kind of forces that are required to be prepared in this framework?
So I think it's important to think about two different parts of the problem. One part of the problem is ensuring the stability and health of the local regions. And that's not primarily a military action. The other aspect of it is indeed, what do the military forces need to look like that would oppose these outbreaks? And if we look at it, since you're asking about the latter, let me answer that first. The traditional large-scale military force is very ineffective in these contexts because it can actually cause more harm than benefit because of the damage of large military action to the socioeconomic system. One has to be extremely careful to differentiate who are the ones that are doing the harm from the ones that are actually part of the society that is being damaged. This requires tremendous amount of cultural knowledge and sensitivity and understanding of those local circumstances. We've seen in Afghanistan tremendous problems with figuring out who is it that we want to attack. And similarly, in Syria, there's a very big ambiguity, as far as we can tell, about who we should support. Should we support the government? Should we support the resistance? Should we support this group or that group? Many of the different groups that are in the resistance may also be terrorist organizations in our view. So figuring out who are the good guys and who are the bad guys in these circumstances is extremely difficult. And the nature of doing that is built upon an understanding of what are the local values and the local organizations that are sustaining the system locally and how to reinforce that. So that type of knowledge is not something that a conventional military force is designed to address, designed to know. The force that we have developed that does have that capability are special forces that were extremely successful in Afghanistan right at the beginning in working with the local population in achieving the collapse of the ones that were disruptive of order as far as we understood it in that context. The ability to do that, again, requires in some sense being embedded in the local system rather than being foreign to it. And it's helpful to think about a biological analogy here. And the analogy is not just an analogy, really. It's a mathematical correspondence. And this is, if we think about a biological organism and the world is behaving as a single organism, then the organism has multiple tissues. Different parts of it are doing different kinds of tasks. And they have, and the analog in societies, they have different cultures. And that's a positive thing because having all those different parts of the system contributes and can contribute to the well-being of the organism as a whole. But you have to have a system that can identify when there are disruptive elements of the present. And that, in a biological context, that's the immune system. An immune system has cells that are embedded throughout the system and serve in the careful role of identifying what are the cells that are disruptive and which ones are not. And that's far from easy task. because cells that are normal cells can be converted to cancerous cells. You can have cells that are in principle alien, all of the different kinds of cells that are in our intestines, for example, that have different DNA from ours, but they're actually friendly cells. We don't want to attack them. You can make mistakes. The immune system can have autoimmune problems, right? So it's clear that it's a very difficult problem, and we have to have the structures and the capability to make that determination of what is should be supported and what should be opposed. And if we don't do that correctly, then we have the kind of local disruptions that we are experiencing all around the world today. So that's the essential structure that we need in a military context, is to have individuals who are focused on understanding the difference between locally healthy tissues, social tissues, cultures that are working, and the things that are disruptive of them. And to have at the same time the capability of fighting those disruptors, and recognizing that that's a fundamentally difficult problem is an essential part of that task.
Given that complexity, given the degree of sophistication that each individual local conflict carries with it, is this then, and using the biological analogy, is this a strategic framework? Can it evolve into a clear-cut strategic framework that applies to all of these kinds of conflicts in the 21st century?
And the answer is, in some sense, fundamentally yes, but that's the question is, what does it mean to have a strategic framework in this context? And what I've tried to give you here is, in fact, that strategic framework. Recognize that the world is formed out of diverse local tissues whose health has to be protected from those agents that are disruptive of that health. And that process of figuring that out requires tremendous amount of attention to local information and cannot be directed by large-scale actions that are representing the simple goals that we may have thought before that we were trying to support. And among these issues are the recognition that projecting many of our values into these contexts, whether they're ideas about governance or ideas about social values, is guaranteed to create problems rather than benefits. We have to learn to differentiate between universal values, where we don't want people to cause a death and destruction of the system, really, of the people and the system, and differentiate that from what are values that are specific to part of the system. And even if we carry strongly those values with respect to ourselves, with the kind of government we want, the kind of social interactions that we want, the kind of culture that we want, those are local rather than global, and we have to figure out how to separate those two issues. And now, that's one part of the picture, and I wanted to go back and talk about the other part of the picture, which is, how do we reinforce the local health of these tissues? And part of the answer is already present in what I've talked about, which is this respect for local differences. Today, the world is formed out of nation states that have been imposed in various ways through historical events. And they are not organized around the local cultural systems that are naturally present. And we have to revisit that. Now, we can do it, we can think about this as radical change by saying that we have to push the governance down to every local neighborhood of a city or every patch of a country where there is a particular cultural group. But that's actually not necessary. What we need is federal systems. Just like we have municipal governments, we have county governments, we have state governments, and we have a federal government in the U.S., we have to create the right degree of local autonomy so that groups have the decision-making capacity within their communities that they would like to have. And yet at the same time, we have to have the larger structures, including security, needs for security, and so on, that extend all the way up to the global scale. So we no longer have the nations really as independent entities. They're part of this global civilization that is intimately interconnected. And at the same time, that we need to push down decision-making about local things, about school systems, about ordinances, about the, just like we want in communities to have control over decision-making locally so that the values of the community are present there. That's something that doesn't exist in many places in the world. And that's a major cause of friction and a conflict, which weakens the local structures and enables various agents to become the element, larger scale disruptions. So we have to treat the system as having its own natural structure, and by making and enabling the governance and the and other aspects of how local systems are treated, we can strengthen them in light of this vulnerability that we are facing.
And how does this framework stay in place when these groups engage in acts of terror that transcend, that go outside the field of battle?
Well, so this is exactly the piece that I was talking about in terms of having an immune system and military forces. I'm surely not against, and it's clear that we need a global security system. And in the meantime, the best system that we have for doing that are the special forces mm-hmm. that are trained for local understanding of those circumstances. We have to enable them to make decisions based upon local information so that when there are groups, individuals and groups that are threats, they will be recognized and will be contained through their actions.
What role is there, if any, in this framework and in this world today for what we think of as the traditional kind of land, sea, and air elements of defense?
I would, at this point in time, not dismiss the need for such forces. I think that we are beginning only to see the transformation of the Earth into this collective that I've been talking about, and we need a significantly more extended time before we would conclude that such forces are not needed.
And finally, talk a little bit about how far along you think we are in terms of the various organizations within the within governments around the world to recognizing the reality of this framework today.
I think the biggest problem right now, from my perspective in terms of the conversation, is the consensus. It's called the Westphalia Agreement. Consensus is the idea that nation states are the entities of global autonomy. We have to allow that there will be that we have a multi-scale structure ranging from communities to the globe as a whole. And when we're dealing right now with crises, such as, for example, the crisis in Syria, we are continuing to frame it in terms of the Syria situation rather than trying to identify the local communities and the solutions that the local communities need. Syria is a patchwork of local geographic areas with distinct ethnic groups, ethnic, cultural, religious, linguistic groups. Until we understand that the solutions to stability are present at the local level, we won't really be able to create robust systems. That doesn't mean that there won't be an entity called Syria, but to ask that the central building block of governance will be the national structure is not taking into consideration the local needs. And it also becomes much less an issue what the national government looks like if the local governments have their essential autonomy. And so these are this balance is not yet, I think, sufficiently appreciated in the global political dialogue. Part of the reason is that people are afraid that if one creates local autonomy, that one will end up with fragmentation. We've seen in the UK and in Spain and other places that there are movements to local, to nationalization of local areas. And that's reflecting of this overall tendency that we have that now that nations are not the essential protectors of the security, but rather the global system is the system that is being protected, that there is a move towards local autonomy rather than being afraid of that process. And I understand that the existing authorities are afraid of that process. We have to try to figure out what are the best ways to provide the kind of local autonomy that people want while recognizing that there is no true autonomy today. We are all part of the global system, and that drives us to have institutions of global engagement as well as regional, national, local, municipal, and so on. And we have to figure out what kinds of authority should be present at each level of organization.
And there's an interesting irony in that the more global we become, the more there is this powerful need for this kind of local control.
Absolutely right.
Professor Yanir Bar-Yam, thanks for talking to us today here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you'll join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share it and help other people find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.